Welcome to Voyage of the Geek for another week. Joining me as always, Rick Legato, Tom McGill, Dan Miller. My name's Dave Scotland, and we basically pick apart some classic cinema, some not-so-classic cinema. If you saw our last show, I fought tooth and nail not to use the word classic inappropriately. So I didn't use it. Which was...
appropriate.
Free Jack was the movie that I'm referring to. So... Gentlemen, we are looking at the 1977 sci-fi classic from Steven Spielberg, when cut-off Levi jeans was the uniform of the average director in those days, with the Ford Coppola and young Lucas and Spielberg and the rest of the American Zoetrope. Is that the company that they formed?
And beards.
Yeah, a bunch of beards, a bunch of UC film graduates. And so this film sort of comes out of that stable of creative artistic endeavour. And Spielberg, I believe, was really on top of his game at this part of his career, so for such an early part of his career, and we'll talk about that later. So before we start, what's your connection to the film as far as when did you find this film? Did you watch it when you were younger? Rick, when did you come across this film?
First of all, what is this film?
Close Encounters. Did I not say?
I think you didn't.
You didn't have a waffling close, on about Steven Spielberg.
You didn't have a Close Encounter
with the title. So yes, Close Encounters of the Third Kind. Mm-hmm. Some often shortened to Close Encounters.
Yeah, it must have been sometime after it came out, because 1977 was the year of Star Wars. It blew my mind. And I don't remember it from around then, so I must have seen it sometime.
Like video, sort of early 80s video, yeah.
I've got a vague memory of seeing it at a drive-in somewhere.
It looks spookier on the poster when you're a young kid to what it was really all about. But then when you watch it, there are some sequences that are a little spooky.
It was re-released 3 years later, so you might have seen it in the 80s.
Yeah, it might have been that.
What about you, Tom?
I saw it on television in the mid-80s.
Some sort of TV commercial interrupted rerun?
No. It's Germany.
There's no TV commercials in Germany.
Not at the time when that were all stately television. There was TV commercials, but not in the middle of your movie. Nice. Before the movie, after the movie, but
it's very civilized.
Certainly not during. No.
Fucking Germans. They know how to do it right, don't they?
That's efficient film watching.
It's changed now. Now that we have lots of private channels. Yeah,
and foreign influence.
Yeah, I do remember a few things from the mental image is always the piling of the mashed potatoes and the modeling of the Devil's Tower.
So how old would you have been?
Oh, 15, 14, something like
what
that.
What about you, Rick? Around the same, sort of in that sort 10? Of mid-teens? Oh, you were younger.
Yeah, it creeped me out.
It was creepy early on, and aliens, no matter how cute you want to make them, are still a bit freaky when you don't understand. Yeah, they're monsters. Aliens are monsters to young kids, or at least they were to me and my mates.
I was a big Star Wars fan, as we all were. So I loved my action science fiction. So I remembered that. I don't remember that film fondly. I remembered it being boring. Because I wanted to see the aliens, and they didn't come. And when they finally did come, they took their sweet time and stood around and waved.
Subtle.
Yeah. I was spoiled by George Lucas.
Well, there were some sequences in the film that indicated what were enough to put you in two minds as to whether they were happy, like friendly or not. And that, I think, is some of Spielberg's genius, which we'll talk about later, where you're really unsure of the motives of the nemesis.
My early memories of it were of it being a scary film, seeing it around 10.
So. Yeah, I don't think I sat through the whole thing when I first saw it. It was a little too real, especially some of those kids the scenes with the kid.
Kid, yeah, and the toys, yep, moving around the house and all, yep, that shit.
Spielberg knows how to build an everyman's kid's bedroom. Like, yeah, E.T. is very similar as well. Very similar.
He says in one interview that it's his bedroom, that he does a lot of his own sort of stuff in his films, that there are a lot of semi-autobiographical, yeah. And he's essentially would love to play himself in the main actor roles. Is he essentially he.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's on screen. You can see that. What about you, Dan?
Mine would be very similar to Rick's, actually. I don't think I saw it in the theater when it came out. And then I just picked it up somewhere in between, somehow. Mm. Yeah, probably on the television.
VHS something.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yep.
You know, late night movie thing.
And it just keeps popping up. Mm. You know, you'll see it on reruns, television, advertising, whatever, and it keeps going through anniversaries. Yeah. It'll be 25 year, 30 year. I think it's up to 40 years now. Yeah.
And I remember seeing it later, much older as a teenager, and surprised that it wasn't scary. It was actually a bit slow. I was a bit like Tom.
Yeah.
Because, you know, in my mind, it's a scary film. And then, you know, seeing it old, I'm like, no, it's fine.
If you know that the aliens are friendly, then you're not scared of them anymore.
Yes. Mm. Yeah. Yes. It becomes a very different experience, doesn't it? Because you're not taking bias into the experience. Mm. All right. So what we tend to do is break our review of a film into a couple of episodes, and we tend to kick things off with a little bit of a look at the narrative from a story beat type of thing, not so much from the writing side of things for narrative. Rick has a look at, and the story beat and the story arcs, Dan tends to take us through that process in his segment called What the Plot. And without any wasting any more time, let's jump into What the Plot.
All right, so we're going to go through the movie and have a look at the movie. Usually talk about a log line, try and describe the movie in one sentence. It's a bit of a formula to a log line. So I've been thinking about it. So what's a good log line? It's something like when a man gets psychically contacted, has an experience with aliens, gets psychically contacted, he has to complete his psychic journey to meet the aliens and go to the stars or something like that is the log line.
Like after experiencing an encounter with aliens. John Everyman has a overwhelming desire to be at a certain place at a certain time.
Drawn to the aliens.
Yes, there's some sort of connection.
Joe Public gets fried during a close encounter,
he
turns into a sculpture artist working for aliens.
He train crashes into a divorce.
Yeah.
Yes. That sort of goes unspoken in this film, doesn't it? That is, because he ends up at the end of the film, he's passionate the other girl and forgets all about his family.
It's an important point we might have to return to towards the end.
Yes.
So I tried to break it down into the three-act structure with an inciting incident, and I had a bit of trouble.
Yes, I thought you would.
So the first question I want to ask, because we'll go through the story just in a little bit of detail, first act, second act, third
I think
act.
I know the first question. Who are we following in this story?
Well, who are we following? That's a good one, actually, as well. Who's the hero, you know, or who's the protagonist?
Mm-hmm.
And the other one is, what is the inciting incident? Where is the inciting incident in the story? So maybe I'll just leave those two hanging there for a second, and we'll start moving through the narrative. So as we've already discussed, you know, the title of the movie is Close Encounters of the Third Kind. So there's going to be aliens in it.
Mm-hmm.
So the movie kind of starts off by just laying its cards on the table. And it's like the movie's saying, all right, you all know there's going to be aliens in this movie, right? So we're going to start playing alien cards really early. So the first one, the first little scene is in the Mexico desert. I assume it's in Mexico. Who knows where it could be. And there's lots of sand, it's a big sandstorm, and it's very, very difficult to hear everybody. And two of the heroes turn up, or our possible heroes, and they are Dave and Claude. Is that the names?
I think so.
Claude, yeah.
So who are these people?
What? They're our heroes. Did you watch the movie? Dave and Claude.
François Truffaut, who is a UFO hunter. He's Claude.
And who's Dave?
Who's Dave, yeah.
He's the other guy who can speak French.
Bob Balaban.
Oh, Balaban.
Yeah. David Loughlin.
Yeah.
Map reader.
That's his name, Dave.
Okay,
cool. Right?
Yep. I liked his character. He was this disbelieving sort of, what's going on? And everyone else is like, it's every other Tuesday, this shit's going on. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
He's the only one that's sort of looking at it. No, this is bizarre. Why?
So it appears that there's some sort of phone call and groups of people have turned up. There's something amazing happening in this desert in the middle of Mexico.
Yep.
And Claude, the French UFO hunter, turns up and everybody's in a bit of a panic. Where is it? What's going on? What's going on? And it turns out that Dave is the only one who speaks French.
He has to translate French into English and English into French while somebody else translates the English into Spanish.
Yeah.
Because they're talking to Mexican people that are around that location.
And what they find there is it Flight 19?
Yes.
TBDs, the torpedo bombers from Flight 19?
They find them all parked nicely in a circle in the middle of the desert.
And in that nice directorial direction, I think, cinematography decision to have it all in a sandstorm, because it immediately shows urgency. It underlines that these guys are there even though the weather is bad.
It gives a reason for everybody to be shouting.
And be urgent, and it conveys that sense of something important is coming.
I think it's brilliant. Like it set up an uncomfortable, it made you uncomfortable, as in you looked at it and go, I'd hate to be there.
Yeah.
That looks like it would hurt.
Yes.
That sand was blowing so hard. It raised the tension.
Yes.
Because everybody had to yell at each other it was dangerous.
And you couldn't
stuff
hear, and there was the language barrier. Mm. All right, so it turns out that there's these aeroplanes that have disappeared from a long time ago and they turned up in the desert here. What the hell is going on? Mm-hmm. They also have a talk to one of the old timers who's sitting there.
That's right.
He's a bit crazy.
Tackling. Yes.
Yeah, they didn't translate that, which I was.
Did it?
Well, they did in dialogue, they didn't, but they didn't put notes.
Subtitles, yeah.
So the old guy had been talking to the sun, which had been singing to him.
Yes.
I like that he's there in the middle of the desert.
Yeah.
And they look at him. He's terribly sunburned. Mm. And they pick up on that. He said, ooh, he's sunburned.
Yeah, exactly. It was hot yesterday.
We didn't expect that.
He's also covered in sand.
Absolutely.
Okay, so that's the story playing there first. You know, they go through their hand and they've got, I've got a weird card. I'm playing a weird card. So they put that down. Yeah. But then they realize they've got a pair. There's another weird card. Mm-hmm. So the second one is the traffic control.
Yes, that my favourite scene of the film is the air traffic control sequence. The directorial decisions made in that scene of people talking over one another, but the whole time you're still right in there, you know, and the chaos yet measured control that's going on in that, and the fact that the hierarchies come over and start to ask questions about, find out if they want to report, and, you know, there's procedure in brought into it.
So there's two aeroplanes that we gather slowly by listening to half of this conversation, and it's all over the radio, a bit difficult to hear. So there's two aeroplanes and they can both see something weird in the sky, and something weird's going on, nobody quite knows, and everybody suspects.
So they've called the tower to find out, is there anything on radar?
And everybody gathers round and it's all very weird, and then it all kind of dissolves and disappears, and everybody's like...
This used to be the original opening scene for the film.
Okay.
Before they started adding the sandstorm start. So that's probably why you have these sort of two starts to it, because they added the sandstorm in the Mexican desert later.
I didn't know that. I've probably seen the movie in that format. I've probably seen the movie where it starts in that.
I'm not sure that they reshoot. It's just as Steven Spielberg developed the story, that was one of the latest additions.
And the desert part?
The desert part, yeah.
So what happens next in the story is that then the story has in its hand the Queen of Weird Cards. So it decides to play the Queen of Weird Cards. So we go to Indiana.
Mm.
So there's a house on the prairie and there's a big storm and everybody's asleep. And then one of the toys suddenly turns on. Mm. And,
the monkey.
One of the monkeys starts clapping, one of those clappy monkey things.
And that freaks me out when I was a kid.
Yeah.
No, it freaks Daniel out. I watched it last week with my 15-year-old and that freaked him out.
Yeah.
He said, that's scary.
And even the Sesame Street song on the record player in the background, Shape of a Square, and you know, there's just some bizarre shit going on, and then the cars start to drive across the floor. Mm-hmm. And every time I see a toy, I remember that toy from my childhood. Mm. I might not have owned it, but I knew of it, sort of thing.
Mm. I remember reading about the two most scariest Doctor Who episodes ever that were so freaking scary that the Doctor Who people wrote them down in a list and said, you shouldn't probably do these anymore. Yeah. One of them was... Well, both of them are kind of the same. One was when toys turn out to be horrible aliens that kill people.
Yep.
And nobody likes that,
yep.
Right? And the other one was when police officers turn out to be horrible aliens that kill people. So having something that's super familiar like that turn out to... That's really a scary, freaky thing.
Oh, absolutely. It's the basis of Chucky and various
other things. Wrong,
you
know? The whole world is wrong. Yep. So anyway, the cars drive around and something goes weird and then Barry... Is the name of the boy?
Yes.
Barry. Who named shit Barry?
Strange name, isn't it? 1977, maybe it was the trendy.
Large beer-drinking Australians are named Barry.
G'day, I'm Barry.
I have a theory on that, though.
Second small, only to Bruce.
Yeah, not small.
I have a theory for that because it's a bit obvious, but he was only 3 years old and the actor's boy's actual name is Carrie. And so to get a little three-year-old who doesn't understand acting to actually react when you talk to them, maybe they needed to choose a name was similar to his actual name.
It makes sense. It's probably exactly why they did it. Yeah, because it's a fairly arbitrary name. I don't know.
You could look at the script, at the original script, and see if he's already called Barry in there before they cast.
It's a spooky sequence, and playing our cards on the table, the aliens are kind of checking out the house and they're fiddling with stuff, and Barry goes out into the garden and his mum sees him out in the garden, and Barry runs off chasing the aliens, and then his mum runs off after Barry and they're both in the forest and it's all pretty
she, her concern was running in at around about high sixes, low sevens, probably needed to be up around the mid nines.
Yeah.
When she saw the kid at 3 a.m. running across the fucking field.
Yeah.
She seemed pretty casual.
Sky. Yeah.
That's the 70s, man.
Barry. So get in here, you little bastard. And said, not Barry.
So then we swap to the Neary home.
Yes.
So there's a little, so this is kind of where our, I suppose, hero is, right?
I think everything up to this point is probably backstory and context for the film. We're about to meet the family that we're following, or the main protagonist.
And this is where I was having trouble with the inciting incident, because there's this slow crawl into the story where we're playing all our weird cards first before we start really getting into the nitty-gritty. So we're at home with our potential hero. He has a bit of a chaotic home. But the important point is that he's some sort of electrical dude, and his boss calls up and says, "Hey, all the electrics have gone out over the city. Get in your truck and go and drive around and see what's going on."
Yep.
So he eventually does that. So
there's so much going on in those scenes.
In his family's been chaos family. In the like background. Even
she answers the phone and says, "No, you know he can't drive at night. I have to drive at night." And like there's all of this exposition that's just sprinkled into the dialogue. And also the structure of the family is in there. You very quickly realise that he's sort of a bit subordinate to... He does his own thing, but realistically she's calling the shots.
I'll actually be talking about some of those little details.
Oxen. Yeah.
So Roy goes out on the road, and I think we get some shots of big sections of the city blacking out. And and then this is, for me, the one of the only scenes that I... totally remembered from the movie. So Roy is driving in his truck and he's trying to read a map at the same time, and there's some headlights in the back of the back of his thing, and so he's like reading the map and he's trying to wave around the car and go around, and then the car turns off to the side, goes around, and then "You bloody idiot, get off the road,
jackass
and he's like, "Yeah,
yep."
And then there's another car comes up behind him, and you see the lights, and he's like still reading the map, half
waving it.
Yeah, come around, go around.
And then you see the lights go up.
This one goes.
It's a great scene, isn't it? So simple to achieve.
Yeah. So it's these like lights. It's the UFO is behind him.
And it's that Jaws mentality, isn't it? Where you don't show the shark.
Yeah.
And we watched a director's cut, and I've got a feeling the original didn't show as many of the shapes.
That's what I was saying about playing the weird cards, and we know that they seem to show a lot of the aliens in this early opening.
Especially the craft and shadows going across fields and things like that. I'm, from my memory, I can't remember when I When I originally saw it, I can't remember those things. No. I'm pretty sure not seeing them.
Shadow specifically was a later edition.
Yes, yeah. I think that's too much.
No, that's not in there.
Yeah. That's too much.
Yep.
So what we're talking about is that, yeah, there's a big alien-shaped shadow of a ship flying across the fields, and it's like, come on, you just gave it away a bit too much. Mm. But anyway.
So the lights go up.
Yeah, this beam of light comes down onto the car.
I love the way he discovers weirdness is going on. It's really slowly. It's step by step. So he doesn't see the lights go up, right? Because he's still looking at his map.
Attention.
He's staring at a map, and where the camera's in front, and we see the light of his torch through the map, and then we hear the rattling of all the post boxes outside the car over there, and we see him pull the map down, and he shines the torch out, and he sees these things going fucking nuts, and then they stop, and then boom, this raining light comes down, and then the whole experience starts. Mm.
And just if you think about tropes, this is the tractor beam trope we've seen since the 50s or whatever it was. What was the aeroplane in that green beam of light from the UFO, this island Earth.
Yeah, yeah.
So it's that thing, you know. They've got that technology as well.
Yeah.
So anyway, stuff starts going crazy in his car. Car kind of, I don't know, magnetically, electronically, gravitationally goes a bit berserk. And he gets some sunburn, scares the shit out of him.
It starts chasing it, doesn't he? He sort of comes to his senses.
Yeah, flies off.
And then he takes off because he hears on the radio that cops are chasing it, and then other people on the network are chasing it.
Yes, and he kind of follows the thing. Now, because that leads into the next little scene, which I've titled here, Weirdos on the Road.
Yeah.
So as he's driving around, we come across a bunch of weirdo hippie people who have just like, just this strange group of people that are on the side of the road.
Yep.
And Barry comes running up.
Yep.
With his mum Jillian running after him.
Well, Jillian saves Barry from being skittled by Neary's van
and
truck.
And then Neary, he comes
blind,
up next.
Blind bridge, blind turn. Obviously, indoors, you could tell it was a set piece inside a studio somewhere. And Barry's just standing in the middle of the road and about to get mushed, and she saves him and pulls him out of harm's way.
And so then Barry arrives and he gets out of his car and says, "Oh, sorry about that." Then what happens?
We get the UFOs racing.
Three UFOs
following the road,
flying UFOs zap down the road.
Yeah.
With lights blaring,
but they're still chased on the lane. They're following the road.
They're essentially driving down the road, followed by three cop cars following the aliens.
That's right.
So it's like
shitty old cop cars where you only got to turn the wheel and it's the handle like a brick.
And then the cop cars drive across state lines and over a cliff and all sorts of craziness goes on.
And
so
the three UFOs go up into the clouds.
That's right. Yeah. I think we see lights coming the lights come back on. Yeah,
that's right. We see the city light back up.
All right. So we've kind of hit peak weirdness there. Mm-hmm. You know, we've been playing lots of weird cards. Then Roy returns home, and he kind of has to say to his wife, "Hey, you know."
He gets them all out of the bed, and
we've got to go.
It's 3 in the morning, and he tries to take his whole family back to that same location.
So they go back to the weirdo corner, wherever all the weirdos were hanging
where
out.
Where nothing happens.
Yeah, and nothing happens.
So the wife's starting to get a little bit concerned.
So then what happens is we start to go back into the and see, this is my point about the inciting incident. What's going on with this story? The hero hasn't really kicked off yet. He's been freaked out, but he doesn't know what he should be doing or what he has to do.
Well, certainly has an inciting incident, which is when he has the
Is it really, the though?
The, no, yeah. I think it is.
Yeah, I, yeah. Think it,
I think
I've
it
definitely.
Is.
I think part of... After inciting incident, because there has to be, after inciting incident, the hero's journey, there's the refuse the call, where the hero tries to not go.
Yeah. Okay.
That's one of the things, like Luke Skywalker, there's a thing where he's like, oh, I've got to stay at the farm.
Yep. Mm-hmm.
But then there's something that happens that, I forgot what to call it, that they're not able to return to normal.
Yeah. Yeah, and he does. He starts to pull down his clippings and stuff like that.
So coming back is kind of his forced refusal. And then what is it that he spots?
I think he sees a shape.
It's the foam, yeah. First time, I think.
It's the mashed potatoes or the foam, yeah, shaving.
Well, the idea is that he's got this sort of psychic thing in his head that he can't, this idea that he can't get rid of.
Is it audio for him as well? Does he hear the sound?
He mainly hears this shape. He sees this shape, which is some triangular shape that just can't get out of his head.
Yeah.
He keeps drawing it and doodling it, and he makes it out of mashed potato and all sorts of things.
Yeah.
And in fact, in the story, what happens is when he gets his kind of aha moment is he's started making all of this stuff, and it freaks out his family, and they get the shits with him, and he's made a little kind of a mountain.
That's right.
And like then... this is the small one on his train set.
That's more compared to the one he ends up
with. Yeah, this is the small one, right?
And he tries to pull it apart because he's trying to pack it all up and go back to normal so his wife won't leave.
Yeah, he's given up.
And he pulls the top off it, and it's a flat top thing, which is closer to the shape that's been in his head.
Yeah, so he makes it look more like the shape. So even though he tries to give up, it makes it worse.
And then he can't go back.
Once. Then he gives in and says, "All right, fuck it. I'm just going to."
Yeah, because at that point he's happy about it.
Yeah, that's right. And he
once that happens, he says, "Oh, this is going to be awesome! No, check this out. This is great."
He gets excited and starts tearing shit out of his garden and the fence from around the ducks and all sorts of stuff.
And
he just loses his shit.
Yeah, and he just gives in and goes for it. All right, so So he builds the thing, he pisses off his family, and his family says, "All right, we're out of here." Because he's building a gigantic mountain from his garden in his lounge room.
Yeah.
Right. That is throwing the materials in through the kitchen window.
No bricks.
Yeah. 8 feet tall, 20 feet wide, heavily, like severely detailed down to shrubs and trees.
Yes.
A good little anecdote that I want to put in right now because it fits. They built that thing, the prop builder built that thing as one big set piece without measuring the doors of the house. So they delivered it to the house and they couldn't get it in.
Nice.
Such an oversight. So they had to sew it in half, get it in, reassemble it indoors.
You can imagine them building it. They're probably taken over by the aliens themselves. They're like,
can't stop.
Yes.
Like the house already looked like a fucking bomb had hit it before he had the UFO experience. But it was decimated by his modelling exercises.
So, meanwhile, in Indiana, Jillian and Barry are having a similar sort of experience. They're drawing pictures of the same sort of mountain. Mm. And
he's playing music on the xylophone.
Yeah. And meanwhile, we get back to Claude and Dave, and they're
paralleling. They've got a parallel story.
But they're investigating.
To Neary.
Yeah, they're investigating.
Yeah,
they're
and we're not really following a person's discovery
at all. Talk about it, that... one thing Steven Spielberg added when he wrote, ended up writing it, was that he created two parallel stories.
Because
I'll talk about that, but the version before had one story, and they were trying to cram both elements, the two lines, into one storyline.
Yeah,
and they realised they can't, so they needed to.
I think it worked really well. There's juxtaposition there. The thing for me was that it's anything with Neary heavily emotional. Like crazy levels of emotion in his story and in the Barry's mother and whatever, but then every time we go to Truffaut to the team, the UFO hunting team or whatever, they're so measured, calculated. They've got procedures. They know exactly what to go and what to do and all this sort of stuff. And even when they discover things, there's not a lot of emotion with it. Mm. And those two things, jumping back and forward between those things, I think worked really well.
So the CIA team, the alien hunter team, the NATO alien hunter team, they find out about this sort of musical tones. They go to India and there's a bunch of Indian people who just keep singing it. When they ask, "Where did you get it from?" they all like point to the sky.
You just see the hands, don't you? You see the camera looking up to the guy that asked the question on the hill, and there's 500 or 600 people.
Oh, by the way!
And you just see
where did you get
40
that?
Hands all go to the sky at exactly the same time.
Yeah.
It's a powerful scene.
So they're starting to investigate this, and they find out that perhaps this thing, you know, that they've been recording is longitude, latitude coordinates, and they find Wyoming, which is where this Devil's Tower is. So everybody's kind of converging, right? Mm. The heroes are painting it, and the logical people are working it out.
As an audience, we start to realize that there is a message being sent not only to the officials, but also these random humans.
Well, you think...
That shape is an invitation of sorts. It's mentioned later in the dialogue, but that's all of the people that had an experience some way saw that shape and tried to reproduce it either through drawings, painting, sculpture or whatever, but didn't know why, didn't know what it was. A handful realized what it was and tried to go there.
So next we have the spookiest bit. So we're back at Indiana with Barry and Jillian.
Yes.
And this is where the toys go crazy, the fridge opens and shuts by itself, and there's light outside and the alien spaceship turns up and...
It's abduction.
Jillian tries to lock the door to prevent them, and then
And the chimney and the, the floor vents.
Yeah, trying to get in the chimney and everything. And she...
And she's cowered in a corner with protecting her son, and knives are flying all over the place. It is a... That is a horror...
It reminds you of a poltergeist kind of a scene, right?
Yeah, it's very Amityville Horror slash poltergeist.
And at the same time, the son is happy.
Yeah, he's having a ball.
Yeah, he enjoys it because he knows they're the friendly aliens. And he, while she's trying to close things, he's running around opening the doors and trying to let them come in.
That's right.
And we should probably talk about this later in the wrap-up, but I really want to know what's going through the heads of the aliens at this time.
Yeah.
You can imagine that there's like this... team of aliens, and there's like some of them under the house, and they're like, what are they doing? They're like,
it's gun screwing them.
Yeah, we're trying to get in, Captain. Yeah, I mean, imagine them like Star Trek, you know, they beam down and they're like, yes, we've arrived at the house, Captain. You can't seem to get in. We've got the reverse screw extractor.
We're rattling on the door.
You've tried the reverse screw under the floor vents. What else have you tried?
It looks like she's put the cupboard on the vent, Captain. I'm afraid we can't get in that way.
Try the chimney.
Oh, we've got the kid's arms. Pull harder.
Oh, yeah, we got him. I've always had trouble with the whole thing, thinking, what's in it for the aliens with this three-year-old? Just like... Is he a prodigy? Does he add anything to their experience? Why have they chosen him in the middle of Muncie, Indiana, or wherever the fuck he was?
I don't want to get into this too much. We can say this a little later. But it goes back to the TBDs in the desert. They're like, all right, Captain, a little bit to the left, a little bit to the right. Arrange them in a circle. Very good. Flaps up. Lock the cabins. Okay, job done. Thank you, everybody. Let's move on.
And let's hold on to the pilots for another few weeks. We just return the planes and we keep the pilots for a little bit longer.
Yeah. We've got the pilots in the cupboards down low. All right. So meanwhile, the next one, which is a kind of a fun scene, is when the CIA, United Nations maybe. Flag. But the Air Force get involved, and there's that sort of press conference.
Yeah.
You know, where everybody's trying to work out what's going on, and what's happened is the government starts making excuses, right? Mm-hmm. So they're trying to, you know, confuse things. But happily, for the government, the weirdos and the hippies will have these strange theories about what's going on.
Just feeding into the yeah, story the nonsense, that it's all bullshit.
I once saw a Sasquatch. And I'd not like to hear that sound again.
You can see other people at the table going,
shut up.
Trying to get people to believe me. I like that scene.
And we also see a bunch of people in red jumpsuits.
With aviator sunglasses. And
all marching in lockstep.
Yes.
And stern faces.
Short back and sides.
And clipboards under their arm. In unison. They're swinging their clipboards all in unison.
Nice balanced cross-section of humanity to 42 men and... two women in the red suits.
That's right.
Probably not the balance that the aliens were looking for.
Yes, we're hoping to make more of these things.
You're going to be busy, Debbie.
They're the 42 first song.
Put your feet up, Debbie. Yes. All right. So we start to move, I think, now into, we're definitely into the second act. I've got this late idea for the inciting incident. And our hero arrives in Wyoming. Mm. Now, the government... is trying to trick everybody because they want to get everybody out of there so they can talk to the aliens all by themselves. And so they pretend that there's gas, evil, bad gas.
Chemical gas leak
chemical
or something.
Gas leak.
Or was it anthrax?
They were discussing anthrax, but then they said that like a train derailed and spilled some nerve toxin or something that killed all the animals. Mm-hmm.
So essentially what's going to happen, I'm just going to go through this fairly quickly, is our heroes are going to drive around. They kind of think that the gas is real. They're not too sure about the gas. They actually buy some pigeons from a carpetbagger and birds in a cage. So they've got some sort of canary in the mine.
And buy some gas masks.
Yeah, they've got some gas masks instead in case there's trouble.
He tries to go to the mountain, but then gets sort of all the traffic's going the other direction because of the gas leak. But he ends up at that train station, and that's where he finds Jillian.
Yeah, they get together, they meet up again, so they
and decide to try to sneak in.
Yeah, and eventually they get caught and they get taken to the army base. Now,
not before they see livestock all dead on the road and everything. So they're still in two minds. They're not sure the birds are alive, but all of the livestock around in the paddocks are all dead. So they keep going. I like that scene when they get captured. The guy brings the cage out of the car and the birds are dead.
Mm-hmm. All right, and I don't like that scene. And I want to stop here for a second by the side of the
story
road.
What do you think happened to the birds there?
What happened to the birds?
Do you think they gassed them like in the car before they pulled them out?
They must have.
So what happens is they've got the birds. So from our point of view, we as the audience, we know that the gas is fake.
Yeah. But we don't know whether they've replaced the gas with, instead of something dangerous, just a sleeping gas. And that's why the
No, we've got no
animals,
indication that it's
no, we
anything.
Don't. Well,
no,
we do later.
We do later, but not now.
No, that's right.
And Roy and Jillian think that the gas is probably fake.
Yeah.
And the army dudes know that the gas is fake because they're part of the... Well, I don't know. But they take out the pigeons out of the car... And they're alive, and then we kind of switch around, and literally 2 seconds later, he takes them in front of the camera, and the pigeons are dead, and our heroes see the pigeon are dead.
Yeah, yeah.
What's going on there with the story? That doesn't make any sense.
I thought it was to kind of show how ruthless the government was.
Yeah,
and it certainly did that.
And that they were like prepared to gas or kill those pigeons, you know, quickly on the spot, like you know that they're full on. They're not mucking around and trying to get this.
Then why didn't we see him, like, you know, pull out a very tiny silenced pistol and he's like, pew, pew, and he, like, kills the two pigeons, you know, something like that. Because we didn't see any of that.
No, we didn't.
So we as the audience think, maybe it was gas. It's gas.
That's the reason for doing it. I believe he's deliberately done it to put you in two minds whether the gas is real or whether they've actually gassed this area or not.
I don't think it serves the story well because later Roy has to summon up all his courage and take off his gas mask and go outside.
In the helicopter.
So I would have preferred if instead of that, they take the pigeons and the pigeons are still alive and then Roy sees them still alive and gets taken away into another. And just as they're driving away, this was my vision, is that Roy looks out of the window and he sees the pigeons fly off.
Yeah, okay. But then it wouldn't have taken as much guts to take off the mask.
Yeah.
It shows the resolve that despite that, he's still going to do it.
But and that gives that stage, him a reason to take off the mask because he knows now that it's okay. Because I know everybody else can say to him, don't do it, don't do it, don't do it. He says, no, it's fine, you know. And we, I don't know.
Yeah, he...
But the way I see it is that he sees through the illusion because he doesn't have a mask and he's breathing it fine. So evidence that the most important bit of evidence is telling him it's fine.
Yeah.
But then he has all these other things telling him it's not. And in the end, he's kind of like...
Well, when they get arrested, he's wearing the mask. At the time when the pigeons are dead, they're all wearing the mask at the time. Mm.
All right, so keeping moving on. There's Claude and Dave have a bit of an interaction with him. They do a bit of an interview, and there's a bit of a swap of knowledge about we know what's going on and you know, and both parties, Roy, and they think, well, everybody, what's going on?
Mm-hmm.
Because we know that you have been dreaming of this thing and, you know... Then now Roy knows that there's other people investigating, so there's a bit of a swap of knowledge. And then they climb Devil's Tower.
Yeah, they sneak off. They were supposed to be on the helicopter to be taken out.
But that's when they take their brave pills and they take off the gas mask.
And make a run for it.
Screw you, guys. We're going to run up the hill.
And they take a red shirt with them because we need a disposable person.
Yeah, they took the red shirt, didn't they?
Took a red shirt.
He was doomed as soon as he stepped out of that chopper. Mm-hmm. Something's going to happen.
So there's three little Indians.
Running across a paddock.
And then there were two.
And Truffaut, what are we calling him again? Claude. Claude sees it out the window. Yeah. He sees them escaping across the area and has a bit of a smile. He's trying to champion the idea that these people are here for a reason.
They were invited.
He suspected.
They were invited.
Yeah. Yes.
By these tones.
They belong here more than we.
And I thought that was good for his character. That's when we started to really see
that. We sympathise with him a bit, that he's not one of those jerks.
Yes, he's not a company man. Mm. Yeah, he's a scientist. Mm. He tries to make sense of it in amongst all these military dickheads.
And then we hit Act 3 where, you know, the light show happens.
Yep.
We play the music.
Red shirt.
The red shirt, he's already gone.
Long gone.
Play the music.
So they've found that they've built a base on the... far side of Devil's Tower.
Mm-hmm.
And they find that base.
It's a landing strip.
Yeah, there's a it's an air base, basically.
Yep.
And then
they play some music.
The light show starts.
The aliens turn up. The aliens play some music. Everybody has a bit of a sing song.
Yep. What did you think of that? That airbase, the set dressing, the
oh, the airbase.
It was interesting, wasn't it?
They had an awful lot of those dishes that look like dishes that turn left and right.
Remember that whirling thing that was at head height?
Yeah.
It's like someone's going to lose their melon there.
Yeah.
Right in the middle of everybody.
A lot of instruments and one single keyboard in the middle and a huge big ass thing that shows lights. Mm. Whenever they play a note, they show certain light goes on when they play a note.
Yeah, the big panel. And the sound space was really interesting too, because you hear a lot of echo because it's outside. There's a big canyon there and there's a big mountain. And so every time someone gets on and announces something, you hear it reverberate. And then when the reverberation stops, you can almost hear the crickets and stuff to remind you that you're in the middle of nowhere.
Mm-hmm.
And then the technology comes back in again and then the crickets come in again. And that keeps happening throughout that whole sequence.
So they build up a bit of tension and a few aliens arrive and they say hello musically.
Little mini aliens.
Little mini ones, the ones that the cops were chasing on the road.
Yeah.
And then some more arrive and then lots arrive and then the big mothership turns up.
Well, before the mothership, the three main little aliens sort of all hover and they start to have a little bit of a communication with the musical notes.
Mm-hmm.
And the three aliens finish the five tones, so I think the guy goes doo doo boo 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 and the lights, and then they float up and they think that the whole event is finished. They sort of start packing up, don't they? They start winding cables up and things like that, that it's all over. And then they pick up something on radar.
And then that land, the big spaceship lands, and first of all, it like disgorges all these people that they've been collecting from the Bermuda Triangle and whatnot. And says, just been borrowing a few of your people here, have them back. And then the then Alien Jesus comes out and stands there and bees Alien Jesus.
There were a couple of different variations of aliens,
yeah,
weren't
different
there?
Races. Yeah. Different
he was kind of like the Slender Man variant.
Yeah, bizarre looking.
He was like
thing.
The rock star, and he was like, hey, look at me.
Mm.
And then all the little aliens.
They were kids, weren't they?
Kitty aliens.
Lycra and big helmets that had fixed googly eyes on the front, sort of thing. They were a bit weird, but the innocence of them running around, not really knowing what to do, I think helped. I think he knew what he was doing by casting them.
And then
he exclusively girls. All girls, because they move more graciously than boys. And so they were there for 2 months or so training. I don't know why they needed so long, but they were there. They had been training in all their moves. They did so many different variations.
Yeah. They looked about six or seven.
Yeah.
So there's three different types of aliens? Sound right?
At least.
I thought there was.
Yeah, there's the Slender Man, there's the kids, and then there's
the final one.
And then
the middle-sized one.
Yeah, the grey man, the typical.
Yeah.
Well, then the guys in the red suits with the one woman go on board. And
there were two
not before
women.
Were
there two women?
Not before they have a religious service.
Oh, yes, that's right.
In there as well.
Final ointments. Yes.
Those aliens are probably going to be ear-bashed with religious nonsense.
Well,
by
this time, Barry has come off the alien ship and gone and found his mother.
Yep, so that's all
and
happy.
And Neary is now standing with all the scientists, and Truffaut looks across at him and says,
want a suit?
What do you want?
Yeah, you want a red suit, basically. You're interested in one of these red suits. And I like that sequence where they're asking him all these questions and like bizarre questions, because they've only got a couple of minutes to work out, is he the mate of the right stuff, sort of thing? Mm. And Truffaut, the whole time, that doesn't mean anything. He belongs. He's the only one that belongs.
Yeah, he was the one who was invited. So they pack him up on the spaceship and off into space. And we're done. Yeah. All the credits.
Yeah, the end. That's it. Everybody lives happily ever after.
So, well, I want to wrap it up with one last comment, which is about the sequel. Mm. There should never be a sequel to this movie.
No, there shouldn't.
If there is ever going to be one, some idiot will call it Close Encounters of the Fourth Kind, because they're stupid.
I haven't seen the first two parts yet.
Yes. Then they'll do a prequel and a double prequel.
Yep.
But if there is...
The sequel could be what happens when they get back to their planet.
No.
Who's this riffraff?
No.
Told you to get some decent abductees. Yeah,
not these religious idiots. No. It should be, and this is kind of Spielberg's point about the mistake that he made with the movie, and that was he left Neri to be the kind of hero... But he's also a jerk to his family because he just builds a mountain in their thing and then he just fucks off.
Yes.
And he doesn't even say goodbye. He does not even say goodbye.
He doesn't want to have to clean that shit up.
Yes.
I'd rather go in outer space and clean that shit up.
I mean, sorry, the horrible guys. Thing is that the wife will probably never get know. Told yeah, what
that's,
happened to him.
That's what I find rough is that they will never know.
Yeah. Okay, so
children will grow up without a father. And
he just went nuts and suddenly he's gone. They'll be dredging rivers for months and never find a body.
D.B. Cooper, gone.
Oh, except Gillian will probably spill the beans.
Well, she's maybe. Not.
Oh, no, they'll probably euthanize.
She doesn't know the way.
Gillian, yes?
She hasn't left the complex yet. That's right.
She gets, she's pushing up daisies somewhere. So, they should never make a new movie, but that's what it should be if it was about. It's like he has to return home and make amends to his family. He has to clean the living room for the rest of the month or something or other. That's his penalty.
All right. Nice.
We're done.
Well, that's it for another episode of What the Plot. So that was awesome journey through the narrative for this film, and it's going to set us up for our next episode of Voyage of the Geek, where Rick's going to take us through some of the writing that went into the film, and Tom's going to have a look at some of the trivia. So until next time, it's bye from me.
Bye from me.
Auf Wiedersehen.
And bye from me. How many of you are there?